The headlines: Iran's top security official likens the 2015 agreement to an empty shell. Ruling out any talks beyond the JCPOA due to Washington's co-compliance in Europe's inaction. Protesters in Bahrain set fire to an Israeli flag to show their anger at the Israeli Prime Minister's visit. And also, the fallout from the trucker-led Freedom Convoy deepens in Canada as Ottawa Police Chief resigns amid criticism over the handling of the protests. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour: Secretary of Iran's National Security Council says the U.S. and Europe have failed in fulfilling their obligations regarding the 2015 Iran deal in a tweet posted a short while ago. Ali Shamkhani said, because of such inaction, the deal has already turned into an empty shell for Iran, both in terms of the economic benefits and the removal of sanctions. The top security official said there will be no negotiations beyond the deal with a non-compliant Washington and a passive Europe. Currently, Iran and the remaining signatories are engaged in intensive talks in Vienna to revive the accord. Iran is demanding a verifiable removal of sanctions, as well as guarantees that the deal will last beyond the current U.S. administration. The Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Bahrain has caused a lot of outrage there, prompting many people to turn out and make their opposition heard. The protesters marched through the streets of the capital, Manama, and chanted slogans against the Israeli regime and in support of Palestine. They also burnt the Israeli flag. Naftali Bennett's short trip to Manama marks the first such visit by an Israeli leader to Bahrain. Bennett met with Bahrain's King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa and the Prime Minister Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa. The Israeli Prime Minister's trip coincided with the 11th anniversary of Bahraini's uprising against the Al Khalifa rulers. Bahrain normalized ties with Israel last year under a U.S. brokered deal. The Bahraini uprising is still ongoing even after 11 years since it began. No matter how hard the regime has tried, whether it was banning major political opposition groups or by the total suppression of human rights, Bahraini people mark the anniversary of the country's uprising against the Al Khalifa regime.
Bahrain has been in turmoil since a 2011 uprising backed by majority Shias demanding greater civil and political rights from the Saudi-backed monarchy. Since mid-February 2011, thousands of anti-regime protesters have held numerous demonstrations on the streets of Bahrain, calling for the family to relinquish power. Scores of Bahrainis have been killed and hundreds of others injured and arrested in an ongoing crackdown on peaceful demonstrations. Following the repression of the pro-democracy movement in February of 2011, the government of Bahrain established the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry, or BICI, in July the same year. In November 2011, the BICI Commission handed over their finalized report to King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa. The report outlined 26 recommendations for the government of Bahrain. They addressed a number of systematic government abuses. Several recommendations addressed the lack of accountability of government authorities accused of ill-treatment and torture. The BICI Commission put forth suggestions to address Bahraini courts' dismissal of judicial due process procedures and arbitrary detention of peaceful political activities. The Commission sought to address the sectarianized public security force that lacked training in the human rights dimensions of detention and interrogation. Some recommendations also sought to reinstate Bahraini workers and students after their dismissal from businesses and schools for their participation in the pro-democracy protests. However, 11 years after the beginning of Bahrain's popular uprising, the Al Khalifa regime has yet refrained from fully implementing the 26 recommendations and continues its crackdown on any form of dissent. The regime even dissolved its main opposition group, the Al-Wefaq National Islamic Society, and liquidated the group's funds back in 2016. Al-Wefaq has time and again urged international rights groups to visit the notorious Bahraini prisons and inspect the conditions of detention for the political detainees in the kingdom. Also previously, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights had voiced concern over the deplorable condition of imprisoned Bahraini pro-democracy campaigners, warning that political dissidents and opposition figures are slowly dying in the Manama regime's jails and detention centers. The organization called for urgent action in solidarity with jailed Bahraini opposition leader and the Secretary General of the Haq Movement, Hassan Mushaima, as well as imprisoned human rights activist Abdeljalil Abdullah Al-Singas, as the pair suffer from multiple health problems, but are being denied proper health care. Also, political detainee Hossein Barakat died in captivity of Al-Khalifa regime from COVID-19 after being barred from proper medical treatment. Prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who is serving a life sentence in regime prisons, as well as Nabil Rajab, who has been behind bars for criticizing the Al-Khalifa regime's involvement in the Saudi-led military campaign against Yemen, are two other detainees who have played a prominent role in the Bahraini revolution.
Actions that the regime has taken against them will continue to be opposed because the people want to be able to live in freedom and dignity. The government has not shown any receptivity toward the desires of the people.
Bahrain has come under pressure from human rights organizations over its prison conditions, including overcrowding, poor sanitation, and lack of medical care. This also includes sham trials that were held. There have been many reports of regime torture on the detainees. Manama has gone to great lengths to clamp down on any sign of dissent.
Bahrain's top Shia cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, has urged people to remain united in their fight against oppression in the country. Sheikh Qasim said victory can be achieved through unity and patience. He said Bahrain needs a just and equitable constitution that recognizes people's rights, pride, and dignity. Sheikh Qasim stressed that the political conflict there can't be settled unless such a constitution is written. The Shia cleric was speaking on the anniversary of a popular uprising that began in Bahrain on March 14, 2011. Sheikh Qasim had previously urged the regime in Manama to pursue an agreement with the Bahraini opposition instead of increasingly suppressing dissent. Meanwhile, Bahraini opposition groups have called for mass participation in rallies marking the 11th anniversary of the February 14th uprising, as the Al-Khalifa regime continues its heavy-handed crackdown on dissent in the Persian Gulf country. The opposition groups also stressed their faithful adherence to the principles and goals of the 2011 popular uprising stipulated in the Pearl Charter, the foremost of which are putting an end to the dictatorial tribal rule in Bahrain, establishing the right to self-determination and exposing its falsified nature before the international community.
But as we have seen for the past 11 years, they'll continue to fight against these, and we can only hope that other countries will support them.
Pro-democracy protests have continued to be held in Bahrain on a regular basis ever since a popular uprising began in mid-February 2011, but the regime unleashed a harsh crackdown in response, killing many and jailing thousands. The participants demand that the Al-Khalifa regime relinquish power and allow a just system representing all Bahrainis to be established.
Ottawa's police chief resigns amid criticism that he didn't do enough to stop prolonged anti-vax protests that have paralyzed the Canadian capital. The resignation comes as hundreds of trucks remain still parked outside the Canadian Parliament and Prime Minister's office. He says his personnel lack resources to peacefully disperse the protesters, with his defenders voicing fears that the use of force could stoke violence. On Monday, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers to end protests that have severely affected the country's economy. The demonstrations were started by Canadian truckers opposing an order demanding unvaccinated cross-border drivers to quarantine. The protests have turned into a rallying point for people opposing various policies of Trudeau's government. Canada's dark colonial past once again comes to light with the discovery of dozens of more unmarked graves of Native children. An Indigenous community in Saskatchewan province has found 54 graves of two former residential schools. Saskatchewan Premier has offered sympathy with the Kisikus First Nation, saying they experienced the same shock and despair as other First Nations across Canada. The new discovery brings to more than 1,300 the number of nameless graves found in Canada since last year. The country's authorities forcibly separated Indigenous children from their families during the 19th and 20th century to assimilate them into Canadian society. They were taken to residential schools run by the Catholic Church, where many were subjected to physical and psychological abuse. The church and the Canadian government have both apologized for the abuses. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg believes Canadian natives suffered many injustices in the process of colonization, including the way their children were treated. Take a listen.
Well, it's not only the children that were devastated. Their parents had their land stolen from them. So it was a theft and a genocide taking place all at once. And if you look back at the history, you see that there really was no intent to deal honestly with there really was. There was some intent after the American Revolution. The natives were against the revolution because they knew that they would be wiped out and they trusted Britain more. So a lot of them came to Canada, were given land, and then the land was taken away again. So, I mean, at the very top, Queen Victoria was had nice relations with chiefs. But when you go down to the level of surveyors and the agents that were sent out at the local level, they were pressured to give the settlers the land, all of the land. It was supposed to be kept, but 90% of it was taken away. So it's not just the children that were, they were taken to be re-educated in order to become white, pseudo-white.
Coronavirus infections hitting a fresh high in South Korea, owing in large part to the fast spread of the Omicron variant. Health officials report over 90,000 new infections in the past 24 hours, a nearly double increase from the previous day. Deaths continue to remain relatively low, with an average of fewer than 50 fatalities a day over the past 50 fatalities a day over the past week. South Korea has been among the most successful countries in containing the outbreak. More than 85% of its population has been fully vaccinated, and nearly 60% has received a booster shot. Authorities have been considering to ease some restrictions, including night curfews and bans on public gatherings. But with the current surge in infections, that could be put in the back burner for a while. And correspondent in Seoul, Frank Smith, says the South Korean government is caught between a rock and a hard place as it needs to deal with increasing infections alongside growing pressure to ease restrictions.
The government's really in a difficult position here. It had social distancing measures restricting the number of people to 6 and a curfew of 9 p.m. for cafes and restaurants across the country. And it had been planning, as you mentioned, to ease those social distancing restrictions because service industry businesses are really suffering. I was at a demonstration yesterday of hundreds of small business owners that want to see those restrictions dropped. At the same time, however, we see Omicron spreading across the country with health authorities here warning it could go over 170,000 per day or even 350,000 per day. So the government is caught between kind of a rock and a hard place here. Add to that, we have a presidential election coming up on March 9th with campaigning just beginning this week.
Gunfire and explosions in Somalia's capital, where security checkpoints and police stations come under a fresh attack, and this time too the culprits are al-Shabaab militants. The number of casualties is still unclear as police are investigating the incident. Last Thursday, the militants, who have links to al-Qaeda, targeted a convoy of parliamentary election delegates in Mogadishu, killing at least 6 people. Almost a decade ago, the al-Shabaab militants were driven out of Mogadishu after an offensive by an African Union force, but they still control some rural areas and frequently launch bombings and gun assaults in Mogadishu and elsewhere. Political divisions and prolonged delays in elections have allowed them to make some gains recently. And a number of British Muslim teaching staff are demanding a new public inquiry after an investigation podcast revealed that government ministers may have fueled an Islamophobic purge based on a fabricated extremism plot. The notorious Trojan Horse affair rocked Britain in 2014 and led the way for the hostile anti-Muslim climate which affects ordinary British Muslims today, Robert Carter headed to Birmingham to speak to the victims of what's now called a witch hunt.
British Muslim victims of a government-backed anti-Islamist crackdown on Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham have issued fresh demands for justice after a new investigation revealed that the government may have acted against them based on bogus extremism threat claims. A podcast series published by the New York Times titled The Trojan Horse Affair alleges that numerous players, including Government Minister Michael Gove, penalized several schools and their staff, despite knowing the accusations weren't credible.
Knowing all of these facts and background, he went on to launch an offensive against our schools and brought down what were, you know, highly successful schools within a matter of months. This was a clear abuse of authority and abuse of power, for which I think that people should be held to account.
The Trojan Horse affair began in 2014 after a mysterious letter was sent anonymously to Birmingham Council. The letter outlined a supposed plot by Muslim extremists to infiltrate, take over and radicalize schools. On the back of the letter, inquiries were launched, followed by an Islamophobic media frenzy, which then led to several Muslim teachers being sacked or banned from their work.
What we observed, and we witnessed this firsthand, was institutional racism, institutional corruption, and institutional Islamophobia. The media had a social responsibility to ensure that there was a balance and a reporting of facts, but this was not the case.
Speaking to Press TV, the Muslims targeted say they are victims of a state-backed witch hunt and that the extremism accusations were devastating.
I was unable to get any job. I was even refused voluntary posts. People wouldn't even accept my voluntary work because my name and personality had been stigmatized. I've been vilified. And the label of extremism and radicalism had been attached to my name. So it made me unemployable, quite frankly.
I would also say to Michael Gove, damages and compensation are due, and my ban and the ban of my fellow colleagues need to be lifted immediately.
After spending the day here in Birmingham, it's very clear that the negative effects that the Trojan Horse affair has had on the Muslim community still resonates very strongly. And with the victims' hunger for justice as strong now as it's ever been, the question is, what will be done to hold those who did any wrongdoing during the affair to account going forward? Robert Carter, Birmingham.
That's a wrap for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Murat Kurnaz, a Turkish citizen born and raised in Bremen, Germany, who says he had travelled to Lahore, Pakistan to study the Holy Quran at a Pakistani school, was handed over to the US even though he had no ties to Al-Qaeda, nor had he visited a terrorist camp. He spent 1,600 days enduring various forms of torture at the US military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. We have prepared for you an article written by Philip Alterman. The piece is titled, Mother of Guantanamo Detainees Still Waiting for US and German Apologies. The mother of a German-born Guantanamo Bay detainee held at the camp for 6 years and tortured has said she's still waiting for an apology or compensation as a new film sheds light on a story she says remains an open wound. In Rabia Gurnaz vs. George W. Bush, which premiered at the Berlin Film Festival on Saturday, 12th of February, the director Andreas Dresen, whose socially engaging filmmaking has led him to be described as Germany's answer to Ken Loach, revisits the case of Murat Kurnaz, who was arrested without explanation in Pakistan in October of 2001, just a month after the suspicious 9/11 attacks. Murat Kurnaz, a Turkish citizen born and raised in Bremen, Germany, who says he had travelled to Lahore, Pakistan to study the Holy Quran at a school affiliated with the Tablighi Jamaat missionary movement, was handed over to the United States, even though he had no ties to Al-Qaeda, nor had he visited a terrorist camp. He spent 1,600 days enduring various forms of torture at the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Kurnaz plays a walk-on part in the film, but its focus is on the story of his mother, Rabia Kurnaz, played by the comedian Meltem Kaptan, and Bernhard Docker, Alexander Scheer, the lawyer she won over to fight for her son's release. Aided by the British actor and activist Vanessa Redgrave, Kurnaz became one of the prominent faces of a class action lawsuit in the United States that eventually won her son the right to legal representation from the U.S. Supreme Court. 15 years after Kurnaz was reunited with her son, in August of 2006, her lawyer has said the blame for his client's miscarriage still lies above all with the United States. Bernhard Docker told The Guardian in an interview, President George W. Bush set up an offshore legal vacuum in the Caribbean and destroyed all the procedural safeguards the Western world has known since the Age of Enlightenment. Prisoners at Guantanamo Bay were held as enemy combatants. Bernhard Docker said, they were treated like outlaws in the Middle Ages, adding, because they rejected our laws, the argument went, they did not deserve the protection of our legal system either. 39 prisoners remain in the camp, more than 20 years after it first opened. Rabia Kurnaz, however, also places blame for her son's ordeal with a country she has lived in since she was 14 years old. She told The Guardian, I hold the German government responsible for what happened to my son, adding, they should have acted more quickly. After all, Murat was born here. Three German intelligence agents interrogated Kurnaz at Guantanamo Bay a year into his detention and came to the conclusion he was innocent and did not pose a threat to national security. According to cables cited by the news magazine Der Spiegel, neither the Pentagon nor the CIA objected to the idea of releasing Murat Kurnaz to Germany. But the Social Democrat Green German government in power at the time did not act, and the then 20-year-old Murat Kurnaz continued to be subjected to torture at Guantanamo Bay. Bernhard Docker said, instead of using that chance for a humanitarian act to help Murat Kurnaz escape torture and give him a fair trial, Germany rejected the US offer and withdrew his rights to residency and return. Docker added, Germany wasn't responsible for Murat Kurnaz's torture, but it was responsible for his malady lasting a lot longer than it should have. This guilt has not been recognized in any way. Frank-Walter Steinmeier, re-elected as Germany's largely ceremonial president recently, was chief of staff at the German Chancellery at the time, and thus tasked with coordinating ties between the country's domestic and foreign intelligence agencies. According to Der Spiegel, Berlin conveyed to Washington in November of 2002 its express wish that Murat Kurnaz would not be returned to Germany. In 2007, Frank-Walter Steinmeier denied there had been an official offer from the United States, while stating it was right to consider the Guantanamo detainee a security risk at the time. Bernard Docker said, "Steinmeier has a dark stain on his conscience, and he doesn't have the decency to admit it. As president, you're meant to have moral authority, and in my view, he's not up to that job if he doesn't correct the mistakes of the past." It was quick to rediscover Kurnaz as one of its citizens after he returned to Germany. Bernhard Docker said one day after he had returned to Bremen, there was a letter from the Turkish consulate reprimanding him for not doing his obligatory military service. Rabie Kurnaz versus George W. Bush gains comic mileage by playing up the cultural differences between the housewife-lawyer pair from northern Germany. Bernhard Docker zips between court dates on a rusty old bike, while Kurnaz roars around Bremen in a wide Mercedes Benz, her tires screeching. Her character tells a friend in the film, "The Germans are smart but slow. You know the saying, start it like a Turk, but finish it like a German." In real life, the pair said they were less of a study in contrast, Docker's law firm a bit less provincial and with more expertise in the US justice system, and Kurnaz's apartment a bit more tidy. However, they both confirm one of the film's best comic moments was real. After Murat Kurnaz's return to Germany had eventually been secured, his mother and lawyer were to announce their triumph at a press conference. But with minutes to go, Rabie Kurnaz was nowhere to be found. Her mission on the global stage complete, she had reassumed her maternal role and gone shopping to find new clothes for her son instead. Bernard Docker said, "We were so annoyed at the time, but afterwards we couldn't stop laughing." Murat Kurnaz, who now works with young people as a social worker at an outdoor sports centre in Bremen, Germany, had seen the film and enjoyed it, his mother said. But she said she struggled to join in the laughter during the screening. It took me right back to that time, and sometimes that made it difficult to laugh. But a smile, yes. Maybe I can smile about it sometimes.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Russia says it's pulling back a number of its soldiers near the Ukraine border. Extensive military drills, however, continue, but some units are going back to their bases. Ukrainian foreign minister says that they have managed with their partners to deter Russia from further escalation. This while the Russian foreign ministry spokeswoman says that the day will go into history as the day that Western war propaganda failed. Stay with us for a discussion of the issue. So let's first go to Brussels, to our correspondent Jerome Hughes, to hear the European side of the story. Jerome, over to you.
Behrouz, I think the latest developments here, tomorrow Wednesday, and also Thursday, NATO defense ministers are due to hold a meeting here at NATO headquarters in Brussels, and there is speculation that they will actually agree on basically expanding NATO infrastructure further east, which has the potential, of course, to ramp up tensions even more and to provoke Moscow. Also tomorrow, European Parliament, there's due to be a lengthy debate in the European Parliament tomorrow, Wednesday, on this very subject, running for 3.5 hours. And it's anticipated, of course, there will be a lot of anti-Russia rhetoric, but also a lot of EU lawmakers who believe that really we have pushed Russia a bit too far and we're seeing the results. And even earlier today, there was a debate in the Parliament on EU defence. And the point was made that while the West is accusing Russia of, you know, being on the brink of breaching international law with a potential invasion into Ukraine, which Moscow denies that's the intention, there's hypocrisy there because we see time and time again breaches of international law. For example, the point was made in the Parliament today, the fact that so many arms are built here and sold that are used, for example, in Yemen. So there is a great deal of hypocrisy. Antony Blinken, you'll remember, the U.S. Secretary of State last week also talked about Russia cutting gas supplies to Europe. And, you know, the analysts I've been speaking to saying this is very unhelpful type of language, especially when it's completely untrue. Russia has fulfilled all its contracts. Gazprom has fulfilled all its contracts with Europe. And yet you have this type of language which creates a perception in the public mind that, you know, it demonizes Russia, which, again, isn't very helpful in terms of how Vladimir Putin and authorities in Russia could respond to the overall crisis. So again, the big developments here in the coming days, I think, will be the NATO defense ministers meeting and also the big debate that we're anticipating in the European Parliament.
Okay, thanks for that, Jerome. Here's our correspondent in Brussels. Now, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi, and these are our guests joining us in this edition. We'll have radio host and journalist Don DeBar from Westport. Also with us will be journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome, Don. Good to have you with us. So the U.S. and NATO have been talking about the inevitability of Russian invasion. Is Russia going to invade Ukraine?
It's a complex question. First of all, the United States has maintained repeatedly that Russia was about to invade Ukraine since 1992. They have maintained repeatedly since the U.S.-backed coup in 2014 that Russia has invaded and is occupying parts of Ukraine. They refer sometimes to Crimea, sometimes to also Donbass region. They have really never presented any evidence to support any of this to the public. We see the kind of evidence that they use in making the assessments that they make public on display at the State Department a week or so ago, where Matt Lee from the AP and a couple of other people in the pool there, by the way, who are generally fairly docile in the face of some of the most absurd things that come out of the State Department, really pressing on the point of evidence for the latest claim that there was, you know, going to be a false flag event and an invasion follow-on in Ukraine. So Russia is confronted with a massing along its borders from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula now of American military assets, including all kinds of anti-missile hardware, which could perhaps neutralize their strategic, mutually assured destruction defense, neutralize that entirely, leaving them open to a first strike by the United States. Men and materiel up at the borders, a militarized state in the bordering states in the Baltics, for example, and in Poland, the borders militarized in all of those places. In Estonia, they announced a week ago that provisions had been made for, you know, another expeditionary force of shock troops of 5,000 or something to, land and, you know, be outfitted and ready for action. Ukraine is massing its own military, such as it is, and the Azov and the other stormtrooper battalions, basically, along the eastern border where the Russian Ukrainians live and their artillery in violation of the Minsk Agreement. Russia is looking at being invaded, and instead of it being from Germany as it was in 1941 with Operation Barbarossa, it's pretty much at the point, with the exception of Belarus, which they failed to take last December, almost at the fullest expression of Hitler's invasion. That's where they would be beginning. Mm-hmm. So for them to put their defenses up against that line, you know, the U.S. is treating that as aggression. I don't know how they're going to counter it if they start seeing movement in the backfield. They'd be insane to not, quote unquote, invade in order to break up the invasion force before it has a chance to sweep across the country. I'm scared, really. It looks very dangerous.
All right. Now, from Belgrade, let me bring in John Bosnett. John, good to have you with us. You know, British Prime Minister Johnson said on Monday that this invasion of Ukraine could take place within 48 hours. So that means in a few hours. So what's the truth behind this imminence of invasion that the U.S. and the U.K. have been talking about recently?
Well, the United States is in standard form speaking out of both sides of its mouth. The United States maintains as its principal position that Russia has already invaded Ukraine and has already seized possession of the Crimea, even though that was done by referendum. The United States does not recognize that. Mm-hmm. And the United States says that the Russian ethnic resistance to take over from Kiev in eastern Ukraine is a Russian invasion. So I don't understand how they can say at one time that there might be a Russian invasion and at the same time simultaneously say that there already is a Russian invasion. That's point one. Point number two is that under no circumstances would anything even closely resembling this be allowed by America on its borders. America would have intervened directly, called it a police action, restoring the peace and restoring stability in a neighboring country. They cannot have it both ways.
Right. Now, Don, Ukraine's defense minister said on Tuesday that he received no information so far indicating the possibility of a Russian invasion of his country shortly. And that's an indication that invasion on Ukraine, maybe it's not a reality. It's only a hype. If you remember, you know, what happened regarding the wars in Afghanistan, in Iraq, that were based on lies of the U.S. and Britain. So how do you see the role that the media in the West has played regarding the crisis over Ukraine?
First, how you reach such a point of unanimity across the media in the U.S., and I would say throughout much of Europe, too, with some important contradictions, on something that is so obviously at least contentious, if not complete fabrication. From Fox to CNN to MSNBC, to Pacifica Radio and Democracy Now! And The Guardian and whatever, so-called progressive outlets. You know, there's a segmented marketing approach to why we are in this problem. But there is a unity of agreement across the board that Russia is some evil threat that has to be dealt with. Fox points to Biden and says Biden is too weak to deal with dangerous Russia. MSNBC was pointing to Trump, saying that Trump is too soft on Russia because he's a Russian puppet, and everything in between. Someone somewhere that makes the decisions about how to broadcast these segmented messages to the American public and the world through the U.S. media outlets, which are the largest in the world, they have decided to organize the military and political structures of the U.S., Europe, and its allies in Asia into a war mode directed at Russia. And there is some indication, including it was a recently re-released RAND study, that you know the intent is to force regime change in Russia that they believe they can do by cranking up this pressure. On the other side of the coin, you know, President Putin and the Russian Duma, by the way, with their own message, which almost unanimously yesterday or today called on President Putin to recognize the Donbass breakaway republics. He has said, look, you guys, this is existential for us. We know what happens next. We're not going to have another replay of World War II. We will fight where we decide to fight if you force a fight. And so, you know, we're looking at a situation analogous to 1962. We even had a little submarine incident over the weekend that could have escalated into nuclear war. The United States probing Russian waters with nuclear submarines. But we don't have John Kennedy sitting in the White House now. Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, John, let's hear your thoughts regarding the role of the Western media in this.
Well, being a journalist myself by profession, I can tell you that what was once a lively media has greatly, greatly descended in quality. I can tell you that there's a kind of a groupthink in the media that's imposed from the top down from the owners of the media. Mm-hmm. And if you don't conform with the groupthink, you lose your job. And that I've seen across media in Europe, in North America, and in Asia. So I can tell you that the military-industrial complex has seized upon the fact that their first weapon in the war is always the media. If they can convince the public that the designated enemy is evil, and then they demonize that enemy as they have been doing with Russia for decades, then they believe that they can get away with quick, short wars. Obviously, this would never be a quick, short war. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that the objective of the NATO side is to develop hysteria, allow the hysteria to give a free hand to the Western governments to provoke a Russian response by putting aggressive attack weaponry on the very border of Russia. And if Russia responds in any way to those provocations, then blame the entire situation on Russia. Mm-hmm. And this cannot wash with any educated person, because we all know that the coup d'etat that overthrew the elected president of Ukraine was run directly out of the U.S. government.
Right. Now, Don, Russia has certain demands, as you know. It wants NATO to pull back troops and weapons from Eastern Europe. It wants Ukraine not to join the military alliance. Tell us why Russia is concerned about NATO's eastward expansion.
For the same reason that the U.S. almost went to nuclear war, because the Soviet Union put a couple of dozen nuclear missiles in Cuba, 90 miles away from the U.S. border. Mm. You know, it changes the strategic balance to a position where the defending nation state has a very limited response time to determine whether or not something is an actual immediate threat or a potential threat. When you have nuclear weapons and you're on a 5 or 3 or 12 minute response time, you have an envelope of that much time to respond, and you can't tell whether or not something coming at you is a nuclear weapon or a flock of birds or whatever. Mm-hmm. You have your finger on the button in defense. You know, it's a dangerous condition. And this is a condition that does not have to exist. The United States has voluntarily organized the former buffer states. That's what the Warsaw Pact was. Buffer states that were negotiated after World War II, after Germany had for the second time in a century invaded Russia. Mm-hmm. And They have swallowed them all up and put in material that now, rather than meaning we're only a week's march from Moscow, puts nuclear missiles 3-4 minutes from Moscow. So that whenever someone in Washington calls Putin up and says, look, we want you to sign over Rosneft, we want Gazprom to be owned by Standard Oil or whatever, we've got our finger on the button. If somebody hiccups, they don't know if this is 30 thermonuclear warheads coming into Moscow or a bird, you know, a flock of birds. It's not a place to be able to conduct normal relations from. And it's exactly the condition that's been imposed on Russia. And Russia has the wherewithal to push back, and they have indicated that they're going to do it. And if you look at it objectively, they have given as much space as they could. Rather than pushing back when they first moved material into East Germany against the promise that was given back by the Reagan administration, George Shultz, all of that, to a number of Russian and officials, they have waited until they're knocking on the door with the most advanced weaponry ever and the largest amount of it that they've faced since Hitler came in.
Okay. Now, John, talking about Moscow's demands, the U.S. and NATO allies have not given a proper response. They've kind of rejected those demands. So does this not mean that this crisis will continue to simmer as long as those demands are not taken heed of?
Well, I think that we're in a situation where if talking doesn't work, psychological pressure might. I want to just retouch two points here about the so-called Cuban missile crisis. Well, actually, the Soviet deployment in Cuba was a response to a prior NATO deployment of missiles in Turkey, which very few people still today know were secretly withdrawn in return for the withdrawal of the Russian missiles, of the Soviet missiles from Cuba. So the provocation, even back then in 1962, was on the side of NATO and on the West. Mm-hmm. And we want to put the shoe on the other foot. We should remember that in World War I, when the German government merely sent a telegram, just sent a telegram to Mexico offering the return of territories that America had taken from Mexico, the American government rolled into action to declare war on Germany.
Right.
If Russia were to respond today to what America has done in Ukraine, staging a coup, sending in advisors, and shipping over weapons, we would already long ago have been at war with Russia directly attacking America. The Americans do not follow their own principles and their own words. They're double-crossing not just Russia, but the entire world.
Mm-hmm. Now, Don, the U.S. Has supplied arms, including Javelin anti-tank missiles, to Ukraine. Germany has refused to provide any weapons, and Kiev is not happy about it. So how do you see Europe's position, especially Germany and France, in this crisis?
Now, people tend to forget even what's happened recently, let alone over the last 50 years or so. Maybe back 54 years, there was a real possibility that Germany, even France, were going to have revolutions and the people were going to join the Soviet bloc or make some third way or whatever out of it. Mm. The popular opinion inside Germany, for example, was highly negative when the Reagan administration introduced cruise missiles into Germany. People there have, and particularly 30, 40 years ago, but even now, a memory of the continent, their countries being devastated by war twice in the 20th century. And the staging of these weapons in their country, they're smart enough, regardless of what even their media says, to understand that those weapons become targets of the Russians in self-defense in the event of a war. And so there is strong opposition to the possibility even of Germany or France or Italy, these countries among the population being the battlefield for a war between the United States and Russia. And so at the bottom of it, you have this percolating. In addition to that, in the United States itself, since the 2020 election, there was an article in Press TV, actually at PressTV.ir, about the January 6th joint session where the ratification of the election took place. Half the population here that watched that stuff unfold understands that the election, or certainly believes, that the election was stolen, and they don't even see this president as being legitimate. 4 years prior to that, the other half of the population didn't think that President Trump was legitimate. Now, generally, when you go to war, you go in with united public opinion. That was organized for both the Iraq wars and every other adventure the U.S. has gone on in the last 50 years. That is an impossible precondition to establish now. And going against Russia is going to be an entirely different kettle of fish, as they say, than going against Iraq, Afghanistan, or, you know, et cetera, Syria, et cetera.
Okay. John, regarding what concerns Russia, I fear we have a flashback at history. Let's remember what the U.S. did to Yugoslavia and what the Europeans did. So is this not, again, maybe another reason why Russia is concerned about NATO's expansion?
Absolutely. As a reporter who was here during the bombing and had 16 of my colleagues killed by American bombing of a television station just like your own, I can tell you that the rules of war for America have no meaning. And that means that the entire concept of an international court of justice, which they do not recognize, the superpower that doesn't recognize the International Court of Justice, means that we are on a knife edge here where no moral code, no written law, or even signed treaty has any validity in the eyes of the American military-industrial complex, which just operates the sitting president as a puppet through the Congress. So I think we're in a very dangerous situation. I think that we are all very, very lucky that a statesman like President Putin is controlling the events here and letting the aggressive NATO side have a good taste of what it feels like to have a Damoclean sword hanging over your head. And that's what the West has been doing to Russia since the end of the Soviet Union. And I think that Russia has to call it end of the game for NATO, and it has drawn the line at the absolute last possible moment. And in that sense, Russia cannot back up on this, and the West must yield. That's the way things stand.
Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this show. Let me thank our guests. We had radio host and journalist Don DeBar in Westford and journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich in Belgrade. And I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi. I'll see you next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim,
or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali alayhi salam, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
The universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam in To My Brother. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time. And in today's world, overcome by evil and darkness, and oppression and slavery, and tyranny and falsehood, a quick look into this beacon of truth and justice, a look into the universal persona of Imam Ali, is greatly useful for making and changing our lives, our families, our societies, and our world into the beautiful world that Allah has planned for humanity.
قال أمير المؤمنين علي عليه السلام: الحلم غطاء ساتر، والعقل حسام قاطع، فاستر خلل خلقك بحلمك، وقاتل هواك بعقلك.
Imam Ali alayhi salam stated, "Forbearance is a curtain for covering, and wisdom is a sharp sword. Therefore, conceal the weakness in your conduct with forbearance, and kill your desires with your wisdom."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's wonderful to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's To My Brother, and we were discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Dear friends, it's interesting, and of course, I believe some of us, if not all of us, have thought about this. But where does humiliation come from, and where does respect and honor come from? Now, if we look through the pages of the Holy Quran, we will find that the Holy Quran says that honor and respect and dignity comes from Allah. Allah is the one who gives honor and dignity to whom He wishes. And likewise, it is Allah whom gives humiliation or disgrace to whom He wishes. Now, we must not think that because Allah is the one who gives honor and respect, and Allah is the one who gives disgrace and humiliation, that this means we have no control over the matter, right? Of course, a person who openly commits sin, who openly opposes the Almighty Allah, a person who openly does evil things, well, that person is not going to be given respect and honor by Allah. And that person themselves, at their own hands, have disgraced themselves. They cannot blame God for their disgrace and humiliation. They did it to themselves. And likewise, a human being who does good, who does righteousness, who has an honorable behavior, who has honorable and noble manners, is a righteous individual, well, that person will gain honor and respect. Now, of course, we do keep in mind that the original source of honor and respect is Allah.